This is What Does It Profit? And I'm your host, Dr. Dawn Carpenter. Each week in this podcast, I'll talk to some of the leading thinkers and researchers, entrepreneurs and executives about things like conscious capitalism, sustainability, and business ethics, things that feel all the more urgent as we as a planet face enormous challenges, climate change, pandemics, demands for social reform. Many of these challenges brought about, some would argue, by capitalism. Each episode, each guest, will bring me a little closer to finding out what does it profit. Here we are, closing in on the end of season one of the What Does It Profit podcast. Thanks for hanging in there with us, and for those of you who are new to the show, welcome to the conversation. For a business show that focuses more on the discussion of moral and social value than it does on economic value, sometimes it might seem like the land of misfit toys. But I assure you it's not. Just wait until season two, launching mid-January. For today, I'm excited to introduce you to one of my favorite modern-day deep thinkers. You may not know his name, but you surely know some of his transformative ideas. How about people, planet, and profit? Yeah, that's him. The triple bottom line? Yep, that's him. Green consumer. Yep, him again. I'm going to introduce you to John Elkington, one of the world's leading authorities on corporate social responsibility and sustainability.
Many people, particularly in business, see the Sustainable Development Goals as an incremental agenda. Let's do more of what we're doing and we'll get by 2030 to where we need to be. They're not an incremental agenda. They're basically about exponential change. Change is nice to have, but we actually got to jump into that breakthrough. And I think people are increasingly minded to at least give it a go.
Today, we're going to talk with John about the next big thing. And it all starts with a question. How can you turn a black swan green? It's not magic. It may mean reinventing capitalism itself, but you see, swans symbolize a potential for change. After all, a black swan is a term used to describe an event that comes as a surprise, is often poorly understood, and has a major impact. On the other end of the spectrum, there are the green swans, which are profound market shifts that generally mean better times are to come. Our guest today is one of the founders of the global sustainability movement, John Elkington. He helps us understand differences between black and green swans. John has written the seminal book on the topic, Green Swans, The Coming Boom in Regenerative Capitalism, and he's also the executive chairman and co-founder of Volan Ventures. Let us welcome to What Does It Profit, John Elkington. John Elkington, welcome to What Does It Profit podcast.
Dawn, it's wonderful to be part of this discussion. I'm looking forward to it immensely.
Oh, great. Well, let's get a few things out of the way. Can I call you Ambassador for the Future?
You can try. Yes, why not?
All right. Can I call you the Dean of the CSR movement?
Oh, for heaven's sake, I have a feeling that this is going to go deeper and deeper and deeper, and I'm not going to like any of it. But I've been called all of these things and some pretty unpleasant things at times as well. So you can call me whatever you like.
Well, I kind of like Greenpeace and pinstripes.
Uh-huh. That was Greenpeace themselves who said that.
Yes, and chief pollinator amongst your friends.
Yes, it was funny. The Financial Times a while back did a piece on my chief pollinator title and said, from a man who doesn't like labels, which is true, I seem to have attracted an awful lot over time.
Well, I tell you, we're going to introduce you to our listeners and they may offer up some of their own because you continue to do very exciting and innovative and inspiring work. And that's what we're going to talk about here today.
Well, thank you.
Well, for those of you listening who don't know John yet, you'll know him by the end of our conversation. He's the founder of the UK-based advisory firm Volans, who is in the business of advising some of the world's largest multinational companies, has been doing it for decades. And so we'll talk all about that and learn a little bit more about John's thinking is on the current state of sustainability, being, I guess I would, I'd call you the father of sustainability, if you allow me that moniker.
That one I won't allow you because, Dawn, I've been called the godfather. I've been called many things of sustainability, but I wasn't the first into the field. And there were people like Gro Harlem Brundtland and a range of people around her in the 70s and 80s. So it's not been exactly a bit part role, but you know, I can't claim to have invented the whole thing.
Okay, Mr. Modesty. I'm sorry, we could go all day long with this, but I won't. That actually brings me to a question I hadn't thought about asking you, but I want to know, who inspires your work?
Oh, dear. Some years ago, I have a personal website, and I just put together a set of people who have influenced me, and it ended up in a list of over 50 people, and some of them well-known, like, you know, Buckminster Fuller, and I mentioned Gro Harlem Brundtland, but some much more recent, and I find that sort of, when I was young, I used to like working with much older people, and I had friendships with people who were twice or three times, four times my age. And now I find it slightly flipped, and I'm sort of tending to work with a lot of younger people. And I find, you know, their interests, their ambitions, immensely energizing. So I could go on all day about influences, but I won't.
You've got to be packed full of energy because you've just polished off your 20th book.
I'm writing my 21st one, which actually has quite a chapter on some of my influences, which is one of the reasons I was tempted to wax lyrical there, but I reined myself in.
That's okay. We're going to dial you back when that one's released, and we'll talk more about it. But in the meantime, tell us about Green Swans, your latest.
It weirdly started off as a book on artificial intelligence, in the sense that I feel more and more of the problems that we face, the challenges that we face, very complex indeed. And people have talked about wicked and super wicked problems, and eventually had a number of examples of those, you know, plastics in the ocean and antibiotic resistance and the pandemic of obesity, chronic disease and diabetes sweeping around the world. And then things like the clogging up of space or the climate emergency, you name it. And they're sort of pressing in. And many of these problems are systemic, which means that they almost seem to resist our attempts to solve them, because we're operating from within a system that's created those problems, and you actually need a new system to actually solve them. So I got fascinated by the work of Nassim Nicholas Taleb quite some time ago, particularly when he did his book, The Black Swan, and that was 2007, just before the financial crash. And what he was talking about largely was changes that came out of the blue were on an enormous scale in terms of impact, and where very often afterwards we look back and thought we'd understood what had happened to us, but really we hadn't, and therefore set ourselves up for the same sort of excursions and adventures all over again. And I thought, well, if black swans mainly take us where we don't want to go and do so exponentially, what would green swans, which actually take us exponentially where we do want to go, what would they look like? And where in the world might we find them? And when I looked around, I found that there were actually quite a lot of examples out there. That was the nucleus of the book.
Well, let's push back for just a minute, because you talk about this concept of a U-bend. Tell us a little bit more about how you see that and what it means.
Firstly, a sort of public health warning in a way. I mean, I did economics in the late 60s. I gave it up after 1 year at university, and partly because it didn't make sense to me what was happening in the wider world, social and environmental concerns, and the way economics was then taught. But the two economists who always lived on in my memory, both of them loathed by my economics professors, one was Nikolai Kondratiev, the other was Joseph Schumpeter. The first influenced the second, and they both said the same thing, that there are long wave cycles and waves in our economies, driven by technology and a bunch of other things. And if you expect things to go in a straight line, you're going to be disappointed. And I think we are now at one of those inflection points where an old order, which is largely sort of macroeconomically and geopolitically been constructed since the Second World War, so Bretton Woods, Marshall Plan, and so on, that sort of reached its sort of expiry date and is sort of starting to unravel around us. So I see people talking about V and U and W-shaped recoveries and even K-shaped ones, which take us up and down at the same time. And I think, you know, we'll see all of those, but underneath all of that, there is this U-bend. And we see these perhaps once in a lifetime, where an old order transitions over time into a new one. And in fact, the old order has to die to some considerable degree for the new one to be able to find its feet. And the transition time, if we're lucky, is about 12 to 15 years at a sort of very rough guess. So this is a process that's only just starting. I think it's probably the most exciting, challenging, and dangerous period of my entire working life. And I'm sort of weirdly looking forward to it, because I think that suddenly things that seemed impossible are beginning to look possible, and possibly in some cases even inevitable.
Well, when you think about this, and I hear you kind of walk us through this, I'm thinking about movements of great populism that we've seen recently. Do you draw those same connections?
Well, I think that populism always comes up in these periods of crisis, where ordinary people sense that the world that they knew is starting to come apart at the seams, and they become confused, and they become concerned, and they become fearful, and then increasingly they become angry, and therefore they want to push back at the system. And also, you know, our democratic systems have staled or tired over time. They've not been refreshed in the way that they perhaps should. And in fact, I pick out three parts of our world which are in the process of being fundamentally disrupted. And the first one is capitalism. The second one is democracy. And the third one is sustainability, which many people may feel is just getting into its stride. My view is that it is, but with a definition which is not fit for purpose. People are still thinking about incremental change when they should be thinking about exponential change en route to systemic change. So yes, I really disrespect, to put it mildly, most populists. They're turning out to be massively incompetent, costing us huge amounts of lives and treasure. But I think they're sort of an opportunistic infection that come, the sort of thing that comes up when a system is diseased, and our economies, our societies, and the natural environment are now all compromised in one way or another. And so we're going to have to regenerate them all simultaneously, which sounds impossible, but I actually think it's eminently doable.
Well, I think we've got a generation of advocates. You know, I'm seeing activists and advocacy as part of the norm of this generation.
And I think one of the things that I often say to people is, you know, I look at Greta Thunberg, and you know, the very fact that a 15 or 16-year-old schoolgirl could end up talking to the UN and with the World Economic Forum and so on and saying the things that she said, I've been very concerned for about 15 years now by the way in which younger people were not standing up, where they weren't voicing their concerns. And in my experience, it wasn't that they didn't have those concerns, they didn't feel anyone was listening. And now suddenly their voice is being heard. And I think that's, again, tremendously exciting.
And perhaps it's that technology that allows that to be more and more possible.
I think it is. But I think also technology swallows up a lot of that energy as well. It sort of sponges up energy that would otherwise go into, you know, proper old style politically driven change. So I think technology, as ever, is a mixture of good, bad, and some really peculiarly ugly facets as well.
All right, you're talking sponging up. Can we now talk about your product Recall?
Yes, we can try. I mean, in a way, it was intuitive. I'm not a massively intellectual person. I think a great deal, but I'm a sort of late developer, and it often takes me quite a while to get to some of the conclusions I ultimately draw. And with the triple bottom line, it was 25 years of that concept, which I come up with in 1994, you know, people, planet, profit, this economic, social, environmental value added or destroyed. And you know, I've been involved in a number of the platforms that have been built up around that sort of thinking. For example, the Global Reporting Initiative, the Dow Jones Sustainability Indexes, the B Corporation movement. And, you know, I love them all to pieces, but I was increasingly concerned that when you looked around the world, that a lot of what was passing for the triple bottom line was a sort of balancing act, is, you know, trading different dimensions of value creation or destruction against each other. And that was never the original intent. The original intent in the book that I did 3 years later, after coining the concept Cannibals with Forks, was about system change. And that sort of got lost along the way. So the Harvard Business Review, through whom I did the product Recall, said it was the first time any management concept had ever been recalled by its originator, which I quite enjoyed.
I think that's pretty healthy.
Well, yes, but it was wonderful, the response. I mean, I had a number of pretty irate responses, but really hundreds upon hundreds upon hundreds of responses, people saying, you know, brave, good timing, we need to rethink about this, but for God's sake, don't throw out the baby with the bathwater. We still need the concept. And where we got to is that there's nothing intrinsically wrong with the triple bottom line. It's just simply that we've framed it, we've considered it within a responsibility paradigm where we're basically saying business, other actors have to be more transparent and more accountable and engage their external stakeholders, the whole stakeholder capitalism notion. They've got to sort of rattle their supply chains and all the rest of it, all of which is fine, except it hasn't worked. And we've now got these systemic crises coming up all around us. And you hear leaders in every sector talking about resilience. And that's a symptom. It's a symptom of the fact that the old order is no longer working. We need to build a new one. And the only way to build long-term resilience is to invest over the long term and to regenerate those systems. And that's where our focus is now, increasingly shifting.
So is that what you mean when you say riding the green swans?
Well, for us, green swans are not individuals. They're not products. They're not companies or brands. They're market trajectories. And therefore, like very big waves crashing through our economies. I sort of often think about this as a sort of a surfing challenge. You've got to catch the wave and then you've got to ride it. And there are all sorts of risks along the way. And I've been lucky enough through my working life to sort of pick up and now ride five of those waves. They started off in 1960. The first one peaked in 1970. We're now in the heart of the fifth one. And I think that's peaking too. The interesting thing is most of the really interesting work and implementation tends to be done during the down waves.
Well, how do you describe the wave we're in now?
I tend to put it just loosely. I call it the Greta wave in the sense that she is an exemplar, sort of a symbol in a way, of what's starting to happen, which is the old order is being massively disrupted by people we've never heard of. And that's as true of technology as it is true of and business models and so on, as it is of the sort of political world that Greta's got herself into. And people often sort of reference Google and how long it is since they kicked off, which is not that long in a human lifetime. And now you've got people like Tesla just exploding out of nowhere, for at least as far as most people are concerned. So we live in an exponential decade. And I think we're going to have to get used to exponential trajectories pressing in on every side. And some of those will be problematic, like the pandemic. And some of them will hold out the opportunity of extraordinary progress in semi-miraculous timescales. We've got to ride both of those trends at the same time.
And so do you think technology, you mentioned Tesla, do you think technology is driving this?
I think it's driving a lot of it. But I also think that people are becoming acutely aware that this is a different world than the one that their parents lived in, infinitely more interconnected. And with implications from that, which are very difficult for normal human brains to address. And then layered in upon that and driving it, as you say, you've got digital technology. So any technology that is now touched by digitalization, whether you think about expert systems and artificial intelligence or autonomous vehicles, the Internet of Everything or synthetic biology or whatever it is, these things are just going berserk all around us. And I think most of them have scarcely even started, and they starting to cross connect with each other, which sort of potentially accelerates the whole process even further, which is massively exciting, but also a big challenge to our politics and to our brains.
Well, one of the things you do, which I think is, for me, some of the more interesting work, is the work you're doing directly with companies. You have an opportunity to get in and work with the leaders of these companies to think about their priorities. Can you tell us any stories?
We won't tell. Oh, I'm sure. It's funny because we've always had a relationship with business that we are unusually open. We don't talk about company A, B, or C or whatever. We name the companies that we're working with. We talk about what works. We also talk about what doesn't work. And part of the purpose of the new book is just to sort of lay out some of those stories, you know, good, bad, and ugly. And we've, over the years, we've worked with a large number of major well-known companies around the world. And a lot of those things have gone well, and we've worked with them for many years. And others, we've resigned the contract. So people won't be surprised that I go back to the 1990s. We were working with the then CEO of Monsanto, and he came to us with a very, very interesting proposition. And it turned out to be flawed because he was very switched on to sustainability issues, but Wall Street really wasn't going to give them the space to put much of that into practice. So we warned that they would hit a wall. 9 months later, they did. Mercifully, we're out of the game by that stage. And I can't say that every company that we've worked with has been a sort of a screaming success. I mean, I remember when we first went into the Ford Motor Company and I was working with Bill Ford, I encouraged him to talk about sport utility vehicles and how unsustainable they were, which he bravely did. And it went into a four-page interview in their first sustainability report. And he got absolutely torn apart by the media, particularly from New York, with people saying, you know, poor little rich kid, he can't see where his money is coming from. His point, though, was that if everyone in the world drives an SUV, a sport utility vehicle, that's going to be a massive problem. Unfortunately, at the time, they were making, I can't remember, something like $14,000 per SUV sold as profit, and cents on some of the smaller compact models that they were making. So it commercially was no contest. I always regret getting him into that position, but then they came back. But if you look at Ford and you look at Detroit and you look at some of the other major companies like Daimler and Mercedes and Volkswagen and so on, they should have seen the electric vehicle thing coming. They're all scrambling now to build their own EVs. So I think by 2023, we're now promised something like 500 electric vehicle models on the road. But these companies should have got themselves around into that space a lot earlier. And you know, Ford was investing in a company called Think at that stage, Norwegian electric vehicle and scooter company. They sold it off because they just couldn't work out what to do with it all. So there's a timing element in all of this. But in the end, I think when these disruptions come along, the incumbents die, to put it broadly, and insurgents come crashing through. And most of those die as well. But a few then become their new incumbents, or there's sort of pivots around which the global economy then starts to turn.
It's almost like you're looking for the brave ones who want to be on the right side of history.
Well, it's interesting, you know, but I mean, the CEO of Shell just recently just said he was very worried that his company and the oil industry was risking being on the wrong side of history, and saying that he really worried that in 10 years people would be looking at what they've been doing and say, how could you possibly have done that? What were you thinking? So yes, we're broadly looking for companies that are moving into that new order. I mean, we work in Finland, you asked for examples, with Neste, which used to be the state-owned oil company, now going very full throttle in, if that isn't the wrong metaphor, but in the circular economy and renewable aviation fuels and energy and so on. And in Spain, we're working with Acciona, which is a...
Wait a minute, I have to stop you there.
Yes.
So Neste, we're going to be flying airplanes on banana peels?
Yes. It's already happening. Some of the airlines have already started to sort of blend in some of these biofuels. And some of them will be based on crops, and that's contentious and contested. But some of them will be increasingly based on domestic refuse. And you already had major airlines like BA advertising. If you went through airports like Heathrow, there would be big ads saying, "We now fly on waste." So I mean, it's the coming thing, but it's more expensive, which has meant the airlines have been pretty loath to move as fast as they should have been moving. But it's got to come, and I think it will come. And then I was just saying that we're working with a big infrastructure and renewable energy company in Spain. It's global. It's called Acciona. And what we're trying to get them to think about is, how do you move from responsibility through the resilience period, where you get, you know, it's seismic and everything is beginning to wobble and shake, to the point where you're actually genuinely regenerative in most of what you do. And that, when the book came out with that subtitle, The Coming Boom in Regenerative Capitalism, in April, I'm sure some people thought I was clinically insane. But then Walmart, a couple of weeks ago, the CEO, Doug McMillon, just announced that he wants Walmart to become a regenerative company. So, well, hallelujah. Walmart isn't my favorite company, it has to be said, and he's largely framing it as environmental regeneration. But nonetheless, I think that's a signal that the world is just beginning to wake up to a very different form of sustainability-related change.
I really want your opinion on why you think that is. Do you think that it's the market saying we demand our companies do better, or is it the obvious that, you know, you look around and you see a planet that's in massive decline, or is it, a fad?
I think it's got elements of all of that. I think it's not mainly because, despite Larry Fink and BlackRock and some big players beginning to come into this recently, it's not primarily because the financial markets, the investors, the insurers, and so on are pushing businesses in this way. Although, you know, some of them have been doing this, and a growing number will do it in the future. I think a large part of it is a generational shift. When I first started to try to engage business sort of 35 years ago, you really struggled to get into companies. It took us 9 months to get into the first company, and only then because they wanted publicity around a particular thing that they were doing at the time. And that generation was just didn't get it, didn't want to know about it, thought people like environmentalists and human rights activists and so on were just troublemakers, borderline communist. And that's where the Greenpeace and pinstripes phrase came from, because I was championing exactly the same agendas, but doing so in boardrooms and C-suites. And the generation that we're working with now is very different from the people we were working with then. These people, this is their future we're talking about. This is, you know, their children's future. They know it's got to be done. They know someone's going to have to do it. If they can see way of managing the risks, they'll increasingly address those. But if they can see, and increasingly there are more of these available market opportunities, then that really jumps things forward a great deal. And then you've got these competitors. You've got people, we talked about Elon Musk and Tesla. You've got people starting to do new stuff, insurgents, which just threatens the business models of many of the incumbents. And there's an extraordinary organization called RethinkX, based in London and San Francisco, Silicon Valley. And they've done a series of reports on transportation and mobility, the cattle ranching and dairying industry, and most recently just launched this week one on energy. And they all show exponential change at a level that is almost unimaginable again in the next sort of 15 to 20 years, with massive shakeouts of people from trucking and all sorts of different sectors, cattle ranching, where and suddenly you're facing the prospect of millions of people being out without a job. And you think about the political consequences of that. I think politics is going to have to evolve extremely rapidly, which is why I put democracy in that sort of trio of disrupted elements of our global system alongside capitalism and sustainability.
Well, we've been guided by the UN sustainability goals for quite some time now, and we're looking at the new 2030 goals. And I guess you're working on a project called Project Breakthrough that's trying to translate these development goals into business action. Do you see this kind of work as kind of an incremental approach, or is it this is the billboard and let's build our businesses toward it? I mean, how do you see it, or how do you sell it? I guess.
Yeah. I think the UN system and a lot of these business-to-business platforms are still very much in the incremental mindset. Although it's interesting that just in the last couple of days, the World Business Council for Sustainable Development has announced that it's going to insist that all of its corporate members set themselves net zero carbon commitments, adopt science-based targets, and a range of other things. That's getting serious. That's trying to drive system change. But working with the UN, it's always frustrating. These are wonderful, well-made, motivated people, but locked in a system which is quite often dysfunctional. And the purpose of the Global Compact is to be inclusive and to pull in as many businesses around the world who want to be part of what they're doing, and that's over 10,000 companies now. And the Sustainable Development Goals are the overarching framework and almost the mantra. And I think they're enormously helpful up to a point, because 17 of anything, 17 goals and 169 targets, is pretty mind-boggling for most people, certainly for me. And I constantly point business to people to the fact that they're all endorsing and signing up and committing to the goals. And I just pick out the first two goals: no poverty and zero hunger by 2030. Really? How are we going to do that? And I think those are almost super exponential goals. And the people who are almost charged with delivering these goals are not yet thinking in a way that would deliver them. So I'm actually at one level pleased that we've got them. At another level, I'm very concerned that we're not going to meet most of those goals by the 2030 target. We might do by the 2040s. That's not fast enough. So the question is, how do we sort of pick ourselves all up by the scruff of the neck, give ourselves a really good shaking, and step up in ways that, people do in war because they have no option. But now we're in a situation which is very much akin to sort of a major global conflict. As some people have said, we've declared war against the planet, and unfortunately we're winning the conflict. We've just got to rethink, and we've got to change our behaviors and change our priorities. And that's tough. I mean, I've been trying to do it with myself. I've been doing it with my pension portfolio. And the system pushes back. The system doesn't want you to do the right thing. At the moment, we've got to make sure that the conditions change and the system encourages exactly what we should be doing.
Well, I think we'll do our small part here by continuing to have this conversation. John, I cannot let you leave the show without asking you the quintessential What Does It Profit podcast question, which is resilience and regeneration. What does it profit?
Well, I think the question could be, who does it profit? And it certainly won't profit some of the people who are going to sacrifice business models that are traditional and highly profitable. You think about fossil fuels as the most notable example, perhaps. But you would have said the same thing during the peak period of slavery. How could we possibly have a profitable business without slaves? And I think if you ask the question, who does it profits all of us in the end, but critically it profits the future generations. And that's always been the central mission of sustainable development. So I don't think anything has changed. It's just simply that our agenda has come much more forcibly into the mainstream, and people are beginning to wake up to what we've been saying all along.
Well, I think of the what as mankind. So, John, you have given us generously of your time, and we certainly appreciate your insights in the conversation today, but in the broader work that you do. So thank you very much for joining us.
And thank you, Dawn. I've enjoyed the exchange. I hope it continues.
This is What Does It Profit? Links to resources related to the issues we've discussed in this episode are in the show notes. I invite you to join our listener referral program and check out the list of our friends on our website, whatdoesitprofitpodcast.com. I also encourage you to check out a really interesting new podcast called Uncertain Things. It was started this year by two journalist friends and roommates, Adam and Vanessa, as a way of finding meaning in these crazy times. They have a free-flowing, far-ranging, and occasionally irreverent conversation with really smart people, historians, economists, moral philosophers, artists, and in January, they'll be talking with me. In our next episode, founder and animating spirit of one of my favorite family businesses, the Mama Agatha Cooking School, Chiara Lima.
Family is really something very important. And we cook because we love what we do. But also for us, cooking is a way to show people how do we love them.
In the meantime, please rate and review us wherever you're listening, and let your friends know about the show. Quick sharing links can be found on our website. Ratings, reviews, and subscriptions on your favorite podcast platform means so much to us. We would love to hear from you. Show ideas and comments are always welcome. Follow us on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Twitter at WDIP Podcast. What Does It Profit Podcast is written and hosted by me, Dr. Dawn Carpenter. The show is produced by Jordan Gaspour. Executive producers are Nate Toby and Barbara Landis. Special thanks to our talented interns, Nate, Niels, Hannah, and Andrew, and our friends at Georgetown University's McDonough School of Business, Kalmanovitz Initiative for Labor and the Working Poor, Business for Impact, the Beck Center for Social Impact and Innovation, the DC Chapter of Conscious Capitalism, and Switchin' Board Studios. Before I let you go, let me remind you to never stop asking yourself, what does it profit?